The following is a recording of the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We are located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. We are also located on the web at www.tpuuf.org. Please come visit us.
Putting a couple of unobtrusive pieces of paper in the right place.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Sunday worship with the Thomas Paine Unitarian Universalist Fellowship. We're located in Collegeville, Pennsylvania, on the web at tpuuf.org, on social media, and wherever you may be joining us this bright fall morning via Zoom. A special welcome to anyone visiting us for the first or second time, or for the first time in a long time. If you're not already or not still connected with us, we invite you to fill out our virtual visitors card. You'll find a link to that card in our Zoom chat box. Filling out that card provides you the opportunity to become more aware of services, programs, and activities here at the Thomas Paine UU Fellowship. I'm Jerry Lazzaro. I chair the worship committee at the Thomas Paine Fellowship. And on behalf of the fellowship, I want you to know that whoever you are, from wherever you've come, wherever you may be on your life's journey, on your spiritual journey, whatever you must in conscience truly, responsibly believe, whatever your gender or however you identify or express it, whomever you love, whoever loves you, we welcome you into an ever-widening circle of compassion, justice, and peace. And speaking of peace, our service this morning acknowledges the upcoming World Peace Day, observed every year on November 17th. Now, I may have confused some of you by this announcement. You might be thinking, hold on, wasn't there a Worldwide Day of Peace sometime back in September? And you'd be spot on. September 16th was International Peace Day 2021. See, back in 1981, the United Nations passed a resolution calling all nations to observe a 24-hour ceasefire and cessation of violence. This UN-established holiday was intended to express global solidarity for building a peaceful and sustainable world. But we all understand that peace is not simply a pause between rounds of gunfire or continuing cycles of violence. That's why a movement began in 1997 to focus attention on fundamental, continuous, more personal commitments to nonviolent resolution of conflict and the precipitation of violence, right? And to the alleviation of social and economic conditions that breed conflict. World Peace Day was a grassroots effort to promote the idea that peace also involves the existence of healthy or newly healed interpersonal as well as international relationships. A world truly at peace would be a world in which our first UU principle prevails, wouldn't it? That is, a world in which the worth and dignity of all persons is affirmed. A world truly at peace is one in which differences are accepted, tolerance persists, conflicts are resolved through dialogue, people's rights are respected, and their voices are heard. This morning's service, Love in the Face of Hate, When Peace is Not Easy, acknowledges this more fundamental, more comprehensive concept of peace. And our guest worship leader this morning, Jim Scott, is eminently qualified to help us more firmly embrace it. Composer, guitarist, singer Jim Scott is one of the most accomplished and widely recognized UU troubadours, the singer-songwriters who make our UU faith more accessible and who inspire us to higher levels of compassion, spiritual awareness, and social activism. Jim's songs are in both our UU hymn books, and he's visited more than 700 UU churches over nearly four decades. Jim helped create the Green Sanctuary program and went on to assemble the Earth and Spirit Songbook, an anthology of songs by many contemporary composers. Jim is formerly a member of the Paul Winter Consort and co-composer of the consort's Misa Gaia Earth Mass. Jim has toured the world, recorded a number of CDs, published a growing line of choral works. He won the UU Silliman Anthem Contest for his song, I Am Waiting, a song he'll be performing this morning. In fact, almost all the words in music this morning are Jim's own. Jim led worship for us here at the Fellowship this past August, and many of you recall that in 2016, he helped us celebrate the 50th anniversary of the founding of our fellowship by performing a concert and leading worship here. Jim, we are honored and delighted to welcome you back to our pulpit. So let's begin worship this morning by lighting a chalice, the symbol of our UU faith, with Fire of Life, a responsive reading that Jim developed with participants in a workshop on Star Island. Star Island is, of course, a summer home to conferences and workshops sponsored by the Unitarian Universalist Association. Please participate responsively in our chalice lighting with the words that appear on your screen.
Thanks, Jerry. It's a delight to be here with everyone. I'm honored to be back again, and you've become one of my second homes there. I have great affection for your fellowship, and I don't say that everywhere, so thank you very much for having me.
Very welcome.
So you, all the folks out there, you can see where it says Jim or congregation. Jerry's going to be the congregation, or you can mumble along with me if you would like. Fire of life, cleanse our spirits with heat and flame. Illuminate our path towards beloved community.
Light the way of love and peace.
Take our vessels to the flame.
And from the kiln, be raised anew.
Let this be our mantra. Melt our pain.
And burn away confusion.
Ignite our passion.
And spark our voice.
Draw us close to your heart.
And warm our souls.
Blessed be.
Blessed be. Amen. And now for the lighting of our peace lamp, after which Jim will present opening words and lead us in singing our gathering song, one of his compositions, Let This Be a House of Peace.
After I light the peace lamp, your response will be, and with all the people of the world. May peace be with us, and with all the people of the world.
I have a little chalice right here. I can't get it in the camera. Well, okay, it's gonna be right there. I have some words that I did write this down, and I decided to not read it as I wrote it down, but I'm just gonna tell you a bit of a story. Here's a piece of it, and then there's a little more of it later. I have gone to the mosque, the Worcester Islamic Center, that's a mile or two from my house, mile and a half. And I have made great friends there. And it was only a few years ago that I admitted to a friend who runs the laundromat I've never been to the mosque, and I'm a little afraid. I'm not afraid of you guys, but I'm just... But I'm afraid I'm going to do something wrong or something, and it'd just be outside of my comfort zone. And I was just kind of joking, and he said, "Oh, why would that be?" And it's a house of God, and that didn't exactly assuage my fears either. And I happened to say to another friend who is Islamic, and we play tennis, and he had to take time to pray before the tennis or just after at various times. He explained to me, we pray five times a day, so I have to if you're going to be my friend, get used to it. And that's what we do. And so I said, well, I said to Muhammad my friend at the laundromat, I actually used the word I'm afraid or I'm scared I'd do something wrong. He said, oh no, they come in, people come in and they'll sit on the floor, but they have chairs on the side, and you can sit in the chairs on the side, and you might be with some old folks or visitors. They have visitors. And I won't say that I was paralyzed with fright to go to this place, but and I have been to a mosque several times before that. One time back years ago, when that minister in Florida was saying he was going to burn a pile of Korans and everything, people all over the country went to mosques at that time. And I happened to be in Cedar Rapids, Iowa that weekend. And I went, but that was not a service. That was a collection of, and I helped set up chairs. Actually, I got there early with the Unitarian Universalist minister. And we set up 50 or 60 chairs. And 300 people showed up. So we were running to get more chairs and more chairs and more chairs. And I told people, people of Cedar Rapids, you've just revived my faith in humanity, that we can go, perhaps this is unfamiliar to lots of you and me too. And a young guy that morning, totally American guy, hip hop culture kind of guy, I was almost pained to hear him say, we're not terrorists. Gosh, is that what we have to do you know, to our with our guests in the mosque and so on, is to explain ourselves. And yes, of course, it is. My friends of color are, you know, constantly have to be representatives of their culture to the white, the white eye. So you know what I'm talking about. So I went though to the mosque this morning. Muhammad, I was going to go with Muhammad, but I didn't. I went by myself and I just walked in the door. Okay, everybody's taking their shoes off. And then we go up these stairs to this place with beautiful, huge carpet with this designs on it that are lines across. And people sit on the artwork of makes lines that people can sit in rows and so on. And it's all, of course, it's all the men. The women go to the back. However, many dads of young girls bring their daughter is sitting with their dad there, and I guess to a certain age. And I'm observing all this, and I sit in the chair on the side. And a young imam gets up, and so the first 45 minutes of the service is a talk. Sometimes conversation, but most of the time it's just someone talking. And then at 45 minutes, then it's prayers, and that, of course, and that'll be in Arabic. But first part is all in English, and there's a guy talking, and he says, "How do we smile in the face of someone that hates us? And how do we smile and try to do good to someone who wants to kill us?" He said, "There's a long history of this. There's always been oppressed people. There's always been the other that is misunderstood and considered to be dangerous or ominous or evil or something like that. And well, that's what we have to live down. In America, that's what we need to do." He said, "You know, this is the most multicultural place." And I told him that I was thinking that at the time. He looked around and there's people of all colors and all different, a number of different ethnic garbs there. And he says, "You know, this is probably the most multicultural place around here. And I'm going to brag and say it's probably the most highly educated as well. As I look all my friends around here, most of us have advanced degrees. We have come from somewhere maybe to advance our lives and so on." So he's just talking like that and saying, "But it's difficult. Isn't it? Nobody said it would be easy, and it's difficult to do this. Can we do it?" He's asking his congregation, "Can we do this? Can we smile in the face of not just adversity, but outspoken hate and, of course, lies being told about us and fearing for our own safety?" So, wow, that wasn't what I expected to hear. I was looking for something foreign and exotic or something, and that's what I heard. I wrote this song based on words by Kenneth Patton, who is a universalist minister. I started at a universalist church in Norwell, Massachusetts, and even at a young age, I remember hearing this name, Kenneth Patton. He was not very far away, 20 miles away in his Universalist meeting house in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he wrote voluminous stuff. He published his own books. He wrote just tons of anything. Many of his poems were in our older hymn book, and several are in the more recent hymn book, is the Gray hymn book, singing the Living Tradition hymn book. He invite people to set his words to music, and he said, "You can change them." Well, I did. So I turned it into rhyming, scanning verse. He said, "Let this be a house of nature and human nature." That was his opening line. Well, I changed it to, "Let this be a house of peace." The song, I'm honored to say, is in our teal hymn book. But don't look it up. It's right. Let this be a house of peace, of nature and humanity, of sorrow and elation. Let this be our house, a haven for the healing, an open room for question and our inspiration. There's a little chant that we do here. You can sing, let this be a house of peace. Sing it again. Let this be a house of peace. Let's do one more time. Let this be a house of peace. Let all in this house be true. Where scientists and mystics abide in reverence here. Let this be our house, a house of our creation, where works of art and melodies consecrate the atmosphere. Here's our part. Let this be a house of peace. Do it again. Let this be a house. Some people sing this, let this be a house. Others can sing, let this be a house of peace. Let this be a house. Let this be a house of peace. Let this be a house. I'll sing both parts. Let this be a house of peace. Pick one. Let this be a house of peace. Let this be a house of peace. A house of peace. The third verse. Let this be a house of prophecy, of visions for our children, be our common themes. Let this be our house of myth and lore and legend, our trove of ancient story and cradle of our tender dreams. Let this be a house of peace. And this is where we start clapping on the offbeat and stepping back and forth and waving our arms. Let this be a house of peace. Let this be. Let this be a house. Let this be a house of peace. A house of peace. House of peace, let this be a house of peace. Let this be a house of peace, of peace. I forgot to warn you that I was only going to do three verses, and I let someone make four slides. I'm new here. These things happen. So, at the mosque, this man, young man, I would guess in his 30s, and he's also runs a business in Framingham, Massachusetts, but he's studying to be an imam. So he was the, as we have intern ministers, and we let them talk, here's the intern imam speaking. And he said, so this is tough, you know, to smile at someone who hates you, to try to just speak a peace, but let's consider the prophet. Remember these stories, and here's two stories he told about the prophet. I'll shorten it. So the prophet is with his friends in this, perhaps in a mosque or somewhere, and they are meeting It's in a city hall or something. And there are people who want to kill his friends. And the mob is assembling outside, and they're gathering stones. And he says to his friends, they want to kill you, but they won't kill me. They might try to harm me, but they won't dare to kill me. So I'll go out the front door and you go out the back door. So the legend is that he went out the front door and he was stoned. People threw stones and swore, cursed at him, and he was bloodied. His white robes were bloody, but he walked a mile through the crowds harassing him, but they didn't kill him, and his friends escaped. And as I say, friends, these were friends and adversaries who were meeting. So he saved everyone. Another story is that he walked every day to the mosque where he would pray, and he'd go by a lot of merchants on the street, and there was a woman who would sell fruit or vegetables or something, and she swore at him and cursed at him and spit at him and told him, you know, said he was terrible, he was evil, and all that. And one day he came by and she wasn't there. And he said to the next merchant, well, where's the woman there? And they said, oh, she's sick. And he went to her and helped her to heal. That's the legend of Muhammad doing that. And there's many stories like that. And just as we would say, or Christians would say, what would Jesus do, or something like that? Can we be like this? Here's the lessons from the Prophet in Islam, saying, you smile and you help and you love, you express love and healing to those people that hate you. That's really, I have to say, it's not what I expected at the mosque. And I left there just joyous, and you know, afterwards they have a coffee hour, and there's people selling stuff and selling cakes and cookies and things. Well, there's some to eat for free, but they're selling. And I bought a beautiful loaf of bread and things, and I left, and I was all happy. It's Friday afternoon, you know, and I have a weekend where I'm going to go to this artist's convocation out in Western Massachusetts. And I drive away, and the van I had at the time started making a huge noise, clattering and banging something. And I drove a little further. It got a little bit better, but something is obviously wrong. So I took it to my friendly garage, and they said, oh, we can fix it this afternoon. So I left it and I walked home from there, and I was slightly aggravated. Now, this is going to cost money. And I'm calling, and they say, oh yeah, we're going to get it. We have to get a part, and it'll be here, but don't worry. We'll work late tonight. And so I called at 5:30 and said, well, not, we're going to get it. Just, you know, hold on. We'll be here till 7 at least. I called at 7:15. They said, another person I hadn't talked to said, oh yeah, it'll be ready tomorrow morning about 10. No, I got to go on a trip tomorrow morning. I got to leave at 6:30. What am I going to do? So now I didn't express aggravation to them. I will at least say that. But now I'm aggravated. No, what am I going to do? I have to rent a car. Now, I live in a little town, Shrewsbury, by Worcester, Massachusetts. And in Worcester, I call every rental car company, and they're closed already. They closed at 6 o'clock on Friday. So I realized I have to go to Boston, to Logan Airport, to get a car. And I can take the train, I can take a taxi to the train, but that's going to take a whole long time. And what am I going to do? So I pay a whole lot of money, get the shuttle to go in and just get into, really, I'm going to end this story, but, you know, a whole lot of money. Yes, okay, how privileged I am. I get on this shuttle, and I get in there, and I realize, oh, I don't have much cash left. Oh, I should give this guy a tip. And I give him the last of my cash that I have. And I get this car, and all they have is a red car, and I don't want a red car. And it's a small red car. And I'll make use of it. I get in the car and I drive away. I'm gonna go find an ATM somewhere so I can get on the Mass Turnpike, and there's gonna be tolls. And oh no, I'm on the access road that goes right to the thing. And now I'm more aggravated. Oh no, what am I gonna do? I get up to the toll booth and I say, I'm sorry, I don't have any money. And the guy is not amused. And okay, pull over there. So I have to sign a thing that says I will send in the money. And so then I drive out of there, and I drive through the tunnels, if you know, the airports over in East Boston. And I'm going to stop at Copley Square. There's a TD Bank, and I'll go there and I'll get money. And so I pull off, and Copley Square is very busy at this point. It's 7 o'clock. No, 8 o'clock or something on a Friday night, but lots of people. And there's a great big sidewalk where I pull up, and it's a no parking place. And I think I never do this. But I'm aggravated. Okay, I can just do it. I'll just get out here and run up. And the ATM is right there, and I can see if a policeman comes along or anything. So I run over. Oh no, the ATM is broken. You have to go through the door and into the place. And there is a woman there, dark skinned. Woman say, oh honey, don't you have an extra dollar? And ordinarily I give money to people. My daughter, even as grown up, she'll say, Dad, are you gonna give that guy some money? And yes, I do. And I know my friends say, don't give them money, they're drug fiends, or they're gonna do whatever, they're just gonna get drunk. Well, I don't know, what would you do if you got a little money? I wouldn't do that, but so I don't make eye contact with her, and I put my card in the door and it unlocks, and I go in and I push the button and I get $60, three $20 bills. And I turn around and leave, and I'm going out the door, and she says, oh, honey, you got a little money. And I realize she is, I would say, I don't mean to make racial profiling or anything, but she's olive skinned and probably North African, and she's wearing a colorful something. Maybe she's Islamic. And I don't make eye contact, and I just walk by, and she said, and she's walking, and there's a lot of people in the sidewalk, but her words are drilling me right in the back. Like, oh, honey, can you spare a little something? And I get in my red car, and I realize I could have said, here's $20, or here's $40, here's $60, here's $320s. You know, yeah, I agree with you. I'm sorry you have to be here. You have every right to use every trick in the book to get us to be generous, to get us to share with you, because I'll bet the world doesn't work right the way for you that it works for me. And here, you know, I'll go back in the ATM, I'll get some more money, and whatever, but I don't. I get in my car and I drive away, and I get back on the turnpike and I drive home, and oh no, I'm getting off at the toll booth. I have gone through, because I have a toll pass on my car, I've gone through the toll pass thing, and I have to get out again and explain to the guy, I'm sorry, I went through the toll pass. So I get home, and I realize I'm shaken from all this, and it just dawns on me. I have no right to be like that. I am so privileged. I had the money to just go into Boston and get a rental car, a red one, in fact, and drive out. The next day, I drive to this artist's thing, and I hang out with people and advance my career talking to people. And I give the car back at Logan Airport on Sunday, and I take the train home, and I the world worked so beautifully for me. I went through a toll booth, or I parked in a no parking zone. No one dragged me out of a car and beat me. No one arrested me. I didn't spend a time in jail. That's the kind of stuff I think we got to wake up to. And I think we say we are a liberal faith, and if anybody's struggling with the word liberal, of course, it's been character assassinated It cost a lot of money to do this, but liberal is a bad word these days, we know. And just to consider that liberal means generous. You know, could I have a liberal portion of that pie on Thanksgiving? You know, liberal, generous, is that what we are? Is that what the right wing attacks us for, is being generous? Yeah, I think it is. And I think that's what we ought to do. And that day, I did not part with my money, but I have thought of it ever since. And it's been several years now. I think of that all the time. What is it going to do to me, you know, to part with money for this? I give large tips. I always have, because I was a musician playing in bars and restaurants and things like that. And musicians had told me all your life, look, you're the privileged one here in this bar. These other people work for not even a minimum wage. And so, you know, we tip well when we are there. We share with our coworkers and so on. Yeah, and we share with our families too. And I don't doubt that come Thanksgiving and Christmas, conservatives share with their families. Liberals just have bigger families. And I forgot what I'm supposed to do next. Oh, yeah. I wrote this song one morning, and often I write songs and I rewrite them and I mess around with them a lot. This song just poured out one morning, and I'd heard news, in fact, about Islamic places, Sudan and about Afghanistan and Iraq and the refugees and the murders that had happened, all kinds of things like that, and the wars, well-funded wars that we have. And I started to write a song and realized, no, this anti-war song I'm writing, I've already written this song. I need to address something else. And suddenly this song just poured out here in this privileged, abundant country of ours. Some people live in a war zone in their own lives, in their own families, in their own heads. A song for all of that. I am waiting in the silence. I am waiting for the dawn. I'm going to pardon me. I'm going to go to the, this is tea. I need a little coffee communion here. In good Unitarian Universalist tradition, let me clear my throat. Thank you. This cup comes from my Lutheran friend. It says, love each other and share. Oh my gosh. That's what I'm talking about. And I've got a cup that says that. Okay. I am waiting in the silence. I am waiting for the dawn. I am often found in reverence, though from many sources drawn. It is not mine to fight for justice, for it will not be won this day. I am peace, and I am waiting for the lost to find their way. You'll not find me set in judgment of the vain or of the weak, but I rise to meet the weary with the solace that they seek. Still I have not fed the hungry, nor strewn wealth among the poor. I am peace and bring but mystery and the patience to endure. I cannot save the suffering from their anger and their pain. Only open doors of insight, so the healing comes again. To the proud, I am elusive. To the humble, I am near. May the broken rise and look beyond the trappings of their fears. I am found among the seasons, autumn's death and spring's rebirth, as relentless their momentum as the turning of the earth. All are welcome in my presence, for only love can conquer hate. I am peace, and for the harvest I have planted and will wait. I realized singing that song, I left out a punchline from the Imam that I had. I have notes here, but I was trying to just tell you that story without notes and just talk. He said, we get this choice to come from love or from fear. And let's choose to come from love. fear is being sold to us and sold to Americans like no time that I can ever remember. The lies, the assault on the truth and the fear that is being taught is making us afraid of each other. A neighbor used to be able to say, hey, you know, I think maybe you're doing that wrong over there. And now we don't dare do this stuff. My daughter last year led a crusade. I didn't want to use that word. Wait a minute. She led a campaign to change the name of our school. Shrewsbury High School is the Colonials. And she tried to explain to people, colonial is a bad word to a lot of people. Colonial empire, colonial theft, colonial whatever. Well, this sports writer named all the schools around. North High School in Worcester is the Polar Bears, because they're in the north, I guess. Well, I think he was thinking about Shrewsbury across the lake. He was thinking about houses. Go over there with the farmers and the rich people on the lake and colonial houses along Maple Street. So the mascot of the school should be a house. There should be a guy dressed as a house running around with columns on the front porch or something. Anyway, it awakened this anger in our town that just in the end of the campaign, where the change was voted down, up comes critical race theory. And here I realize the school department is afraid. The superintendent, the principal, I'll give them this credit, that they are afraid of losing their jobs. And you can read around New England in Maine, a big campaign to throw out the principal because he had the 1619 study, the book, is that a movie too? You know, and apparently that is critical race theory. Nobody knows what critical race theory is, but apparently we do not want to tell the truth about history. A great historian I heard on NPR, you might have heard him too, he said, history is not the study of our lives, it's the way we manage the lies about our past. And there's a professor of history talking. Wow, it really is that it? I have to get a little more serious here. I'm a veteran of back in the I'm so old, back in the Vietnam conflict. I was in the Army. I didn't leave the country. I played in the Army band, and I got out. Well, that's going to be in this story that I'm going to read. But I just want to mention here, a few days after Veterans Day, in this hour, a veteran, an American veteran, will probably commit suicide. About 22 a day commit suicide, and maybe more given a Memorial Day holiday. Well, the number of veterans who die by suicide each day has remained, as I heard on the radio, remained relatively stable over 12 years. That means veterans are killing themselves at twice the rate of civilians. We would like to do something about suicide in general, but I'm angry about that. I'm angry about this society that is built on that. Our privileged and abundant society, I said before, is built on this presumption of peace for some of us. Today in this church, on this street, or where you are, we are safe based on a foundation of war. The wound and the sickness we all carry from that culture of war and collective amnesia and denial metastasizes in the bodies and minds of the ones who are at the front lines of this violence, corruption, and insanity. In any good war, it's a great place for corruption. Illegal stuff goes on in the shadows of every good war. This is a remembrance of a friend of mine. I lived in Eugene, Oregon. I think I'm referring in here to things in Eugene, but Ron was a service member who was part of Veterans of Peace, Veterans for Peace. At Ron's memorial service, there were two Rons remembered. There was the quiet activist I had met, I only relatively slightly knew, but was aware of, going to schools through Veterans for Peace, reading his poetry, speaking personally, eloquently to save even one young person from choosing war as viable. Others eulogized a different, perhaps earlier, Vietnam veteran, Ron, bitter, angry, hard to deal with, having bouts of seizures of anger and unexplainable craziness. I'm sure those elements still smoldered in the blues-loving dancer on his one good leg who made poetry of war. Was it good poetry? Or mediocre? It was the truth of his personal witness, given credible voice in well-crafted phrases that touched on sorrow, pain, anger, madness. It was beyond critique. When the Calc House, that's clergy and laity concerned, closed down, Ron moved up the Mackenzie River and made a life in peaceful surroundings with meditation spots. Didn't have a job, as most of us would recognize, but he withdrew from that school activism, and friends remembered him as a continued presence for peace wherever he was, which was mostly at the hot springs. He cleaned the pools and he just hung out, a good listener on any subject, hardly ever the war, or for that matter, anything approaching self-promotion. He died at the time a year younger than I. The battle that raged in him wells up in me again. I've never figured out if I deserve to have an opinion or a feeling about it. I was spared from the combat, but the promising boys that I lost touch with in my classes in high school, college, that I lost touch with after basic training, did they die? How many? I never asked. In the tunnel vision of my own survival mechanism at the time, in this day and age where most everyone throws out a politically correct thank you for your service to any uniformed soldier we see, and it's happened to me, to my surprise, if for some reason I insert that I was in the Army in a conversation. But back in that other time, the idea proliferated that wearing a uniform could bring accusations of baby killer from some jerk nearby. That was not the norm, and some would claim it was pretty well proven to almost have never happened, mostly false. But servicemen that I knew and ex-servicemen I knew, veterans I knew, believed that it happened a lot. And they had an idea of American life. It made that uniform made one invisible walking down an American street. At that time, it seemed no one knew exactly what to do with someone walking down the street in the middle of a hippie counterculture or something, or someone walking down the street in a uniform. Though we were individuals who were for the war or against war, it didn't affect our brotherhood, sisterhood. When you saw another uniform, you didn't see a stranger. You knew we were all surrounded by lies and corruption. Yet there was some vision of a just society or some hope for a sense of duty that bound us together. Crazy as we might have thought we were from time to time. The morning paper was filled with some politician's latest lies, but the policeman, the fireman, the soldier, or the teacher, maybe not wearing a uniform, or the postal worker still gets up and goes to work to make and maintain that world we believe in. And we hope it's not just our imagination. A friend of mine of color says, you know, I live in a world that doesn't exist yet. I try to hold on to that kind of hope. Well, I never left the country, and I got a 6-month early discharge courtesy of Richard Nixon's Vietnamization of the war and troop reduction. The translation of that cynical public relations manipulation was that thousands of men were coming back from their year abroad with a few months left on their 2-year hitch. You went to basic training, advanced training, infantry or armory training, or some kind of something like that. And then you got maybe a month of leave, and then you would go to your month in Vietnam, your year in Vietnam. Duty promoted them to a higher rank. Drug addiction promoted them not giving a damn about anything. The Army had no jobs to give these malingerers, these nonconformists, and they didn't want them around. There was no drug program at that point. I simply ran out the back door they were being dumped out of. Since then, I've been hesitant to take a position as one directly affected while my peers are steadily dying before their time. I have no doubt the war brought an early end to Ron's life. More veterans have died suicide in the years after that war than are on the wall. Veterans are dying from Afghanistan veterans and Iran veterans and even veterans of other places where you might find a roadside bomb and such. Ron didn't commit suicide. He did not intentionally commit suicide, let me mention. His heart broke and he stopped. He appeared to be winning that battle against the lingering demons, finding this personal refuge that brought him greater peace, but his dentist at his memorial service brought to light another side. Ron's teeth had been progressively ground down to nothing in the tension that went on in his head and his body. Ron and the dentist had helped, made several applications to the VA. The disability came through just after he died. Mr. McNamara's book, An Apology, came out not soon enough for Ron either. Didn't come out soon enough for me either, for many, I imagine. I pray it's come soon enough for someone, and this is still time for lives to change, still time for healing. But for those who died too soon, but not soon enough for that wall in Washington, I think there should be another wall. In my mind, if nowhere else, I'm healed a bit by remembering him. That wall could remember that greater number who have died since Vietnam than died in Vietnam. There was a certain way of saying, sorry about that, in the Vietnam War. It was a thing servicemen would say about anything. It was a joke for anything from tragedy to minor disappointment. Sorry about that. That was not what it said in the letter. That summed up all the cynicism and rage and denial into humor, and it was delivered with this flat expression that decoded into compassion beyond words. Between soldiers, it meant, I've been there. It amounted to hugs and tears and a 21-gun salute. We remember you were a whole lot more than a Vietnam vet, Ron. Your life was rich, you touched many, and you left too soon. Sorry about that. I've made it my part of my job to expand my world. Where I lived in Eugene, Oregon, and it's a pretty white place, but there is no black side of town, or Hispanic side of town, or Native American side of town, where the real estate, I'm sure at some point there probably was redlining, or there was some kind of thing. I'll bet it happened, but you lived there in a relative mix. I remember hearing someone say that this guy, he's a famous pro basketball player now, went to the University of Oregon, and he gets to the University of Oregon, and he's African-American, and he gets there and said, well, where's the black side of town? And someone said, well, there isn't one. And he's a little confused. And you know, if you're a 7-footer, you're a little unusual anyway. I think, and since Eugene, Oregon is a town of athletes, you know, and the Olympic trials go on there, and so on, the athletic mix there is a little bit, and people from all over the world come to work out and get ready and be athletes on an unbelievably high level. There are paths all over town that are wood chips because of the lumber mills and everything. Beautiful, soft running paths everywhere. And you're running out there. Oh my gosh, there's the Olympic 5,000 meter champion. Or, you know, there's such and such. And they're out there running. I moved to central Massachusetts, where Worcester is right there. Multicultural Worcester is right beside me. But I moved to this small town. I met this woman at a Unitarian church, and I went and married her. And now I live with my daughter in this town. And it does have diversity. The school is one third non-white, but it's largely Asian. Chinese, Indian, Japanese, Korean, and some Africans, actually, who then their children become African Americans, grow up as African Americans. It's been an interesting lesson in my privileged town to deal with all of that stuff. And I went looking. That's why I mentioned I intentionally went to the mosque, and I've gone intentionally also to the temple, and I joined the NAACP when I got there. I'd been in the NAACP before, but I deliberately tried to find the diversity and that is America, that I want to believe is America. And I don't mean to if any of this sounds holier than thou, it's just what I've done, you know. And I as a musician, I've been with people of all cultures too, and I really drink that in all the time too. My daughter is her senior year of high school, and she's going to the community college, and she's telling me she wants to be an ethnomusicologist. So I've misled her too. I wrote this little thing, and then I just have some other stuff to say about love in the face of hate, which I guess is what I've been talking about, but that's the title we put on this today. And I don't have any solution. Believe me, I don't. I just write the songs. Wherever you come from exciting expedition or frightening passages, escape from violence or an encounter with enlightenment, experience of ecstasy or endurance of pain, we are glad you have chosen this stop on your journey to be with us. And wherever you're going, may this time of rest, of healing, of search and discovery, and our celebration of value illuminate your way. That's a little thing that I wrote for, you know, a welcome or a opening words or something. And we're wide open now, but I'll put my late opening right in there. In this book, published in 2011, so it's a little time back, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined, Harvard University psychologist Steven Pinker argues that we are now living in the most peaceful era that we've ever had, that humans have ever had on this planet. I've lost a piece of paper. I'm looking while I look, while I look. But anyway, so no surprise, or maybe a surprise to us, that we're not dying in wars the way we used to, the way kings, tyrants would have sent people off, and they were poor people usually, to, you know, get trained to be mercenaries because it was a way to make a living. We're not doing that the way we used to. But hate and distrust is being sold to us, and we must resist. They are slick, these salesmen, but we must see through their criminal intent. We've now added a new human extinction threat. Our own greed has brought us the climate change disaster. And we can add to that the disappearance of divergence of species and what is now called the insect apocalypse. It's a race which will do us in. It's a race between climate change and the disappearing divergence of species and those sorts of things, which one will get us first. But of course, they're all intertwined. There are three times as many people on Earth as when I was born. And that brings us to this new mythology. Three times as many people as when I was a kid. And there's one quarter of the insects. Some scientists said on NPR just recently that half of nature that survived World War II is now gone. What's happened in Australia, the forest, the fires that burned Australia, and is it 2 billion animals died in the disaster? I think we would call that a disaster of biblical proportions. And I use that phrase as there is some real hyperbole in that book. In the 20th century, the partition of India caused the largest migration in the 20th century. 20 million people in the part, this is over what, did we notice this? You know, the partition, Bangladesh and Pakistan and India breaking up post-World War II. 20 million people, 1 million died and 12 million became homeless. Before that, the later half of the 19th century into the early 20th, that was called an age of mass migration. 13 million Italians left their homeland, the largest European ethnic group, and immigrants of Jewish, Irish, and many other ethnicities landed here in America. Borders were more open, workers were needed, travel not so expensive, relatively safe for most, but hate arose at that time. And white supremacy arose too in the early 1920s. And that is when we get the statues to Confederate heroes. And that is also when we get a rise in the colonialism I mentioned before, that we seem to not understand what colonial really is. And since World War II, when in World War II, a great portion of the world was colonial empire. And since then, many, many countries have won their autonomy. They won their liberation from the colonial empires. And in the first half of the 20th century, 6 million African Americans moved from the Jim Crow South to the North, a huge migration that is overlooked and critical race theory that we don't want to bring up. But, the UN High Commission for Refugees counts 65 million displaced people in this decade from 2010 to 2020. The European migrant crisis, Syrians, by far the largest group. Kosovo next. Would you have thought that? Kosovo is in the millions. Afghanistan, Iraq, Albania next. My neighbors, two young girls that love my dog, are from Albania. In the U.S., we're distracted by the migrants now from Mexico, Central and South America. It seems to take the headlines. But the legal immigration, primarily from India, China, all of Asia, is also changing our ethnic makeup, American ethnic makeup. We all know this. Doctors Without Borders counts 70 million displaced people now. That homeless is not the right word to use anymore, is it? Without homes, without a place that is their own to sleep. Wars and crime and violence, but also no water, no food are the motivations for most, for many of those most fleeing wars, crime, violence. But for many, water is now the province of the rich. Private corporations buying water of the world everywhere. Climate change lurks behind all of this, of course. the arable land turned into development. Ethnic violence has increased and hate spreading across the world. There's the Rohingyas fleeing Myanmar, nearly a million. Uyghur Muslims in China, millions and other persecuted, displaced. Millions of people or more. Evidence rising that Chinese government has killed 60 to 100,000 prisoners. I heard this on the radio. And is harvesting human organs. I don't mean to make my Unitarian Universalist friends who have come to church sick to their stomach, but to our stomachs. But we who live on land stolen from one nation, I live on the Blackstone River watershed in what is now called Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Hasn't been called that for very long. We never learned anything about what happened before that in school. We're proud to have resisted the oppression of another nation and won our freedom and liberation from colonization. But it seems we need a perspective of the need for peace for all. We need strong medicine and we need generosity. It's our first principle, the principle of the dignity and worth of all people, of all life, but dignity and worth of every person. Wait a minute, seventh principle is about all life. And our seventh principle, that was our seventh principle. Our second principle is of compassion, love. And our sixth principle, our desire for peace, the goal of peace, it says. Some years ago, I started a petition in my travels, and I was carrying around a petition before we now have an eighth principle. I was calling it, maybe it'll be the eighth principle. I said, we ought to either fix that sixth principle, the goal of peace. How about the way of peace, that nonviolence? Could we get that in there somewhere? And I was carrying this petition around, and I was told, I don't think they'll be mad at me for saying, but I was told by the powers that be before a General Assembly and the moderator of the General Assembly, oh, Jim, don't do this. We've just had this whole, we paid all this money to revisit our seven principles, and don't bring this up. And I chickened out. I didn't do it. But now I think that eighth principle kind of speaks to that in our beloved community. But the way I want to wind this up, and I need to make it shorter. I'm making an executive decision to get back to playing a song for you. We need to remember that generosity. And elections, I don't need to tell you that elections are coming next year. We need to get generous with all our resources and get liberal with all that we can do. And sometimes there's no way around it. It takes courage. It takes courage to meet up with that person who says that thing that absolutely offends you or offends your friend. Are we going to dare to speak up? Are we going to dare to be liberal and generous with our ideas and with our feelings and tell our stories? Because that's what we need to do. I just moved the piece of paper. I had it right here, the piece of paper. I was going to go back and look at the service that I did for you in August to see, did I sing this song back then? If I did, I'm going to be redundant and sing this song again, because I had just written it at the time and I like it. I am in Rockford, Illinois, and Canada geese flew over loudly yesterday, and that's what prompted this song. And I knew enough to not call my poem Wild Geese, but I came to writing about this all, and then it was really when I'd kind of written the poem that I then remembered this minister. He was a Southern Baptist minister that became a Unitarian minister, actually Universalist, and dropped out of that Southern Baptist thing. John DeWolf Hurt was a great talker. He was a Southern talker. His S's whistled, and he would tell you stories about stuff. And I was at his church with a bunch of peace marchers. And he said, these peace marchers have seen the third dimension. And he went into this story about, you know, we're down here on the ground, and it's, of course it's curved, but we think it's flat. And of course there are three dimensions here, but we kind of got two. You look this way and you look that way, and you can't see because there's something in the way, and you walk on the ground. But if you rise up, I got to go up in a hot air balloon. And you know, you go up in this balloon and you see the third dimension. Now, I've been over to Tallahassee, he says, and his S's would whistle. And they got those boats with the glass bottoms. And you go out on, you're out on the lake, and then you look down. Oh my gosh, look what's down there. And you see the third dimension. So, so I put that in the song. And I know there's a, you know, there's a musical group, The Fifth Dimension, and in all our dystopian things nowadays, or our future fiction movies, we've got fourth dimension, fifth dimension, or everything like that. But I'm just talking about the three that we got right here and seeing that. So I'm not, I'm still wondering how poetic it is to say third dimension. Soaring beyond doubt over Earth's solemn gravity, in noisy migration, still they long for their rest. Some kiss their wings as they carve the sky eternal, looking to the night when they'll sleep in their nest. When they sleep in their nest. Voyagers heed signs written on the wide horizon. From the third dimension, find the secrets they seek. Quest for nobility, sustenance, serenity beckons to the grave as it comforts the meek. So may we see over barriers and borderlines, a bond of all beings, over earth, land, and sea, dreaming the world where each life is truly valued, rendering a justice that restores humanity. Spirit of the earth, spirit of the never-ending, from the third dimension, seeing straight to the heart. Spirit moving always just beyond our understanding. In the greater dance, may we each play our part. Spirit of the earth, spirit of the never-ending. From the third dimension, seeing straight to the heart. Spirit moving always just beyond our understanding. In the greater dance, may we each play a part.
Thank you very much, Jim. We've come to that time in our service when we open the floor for those who among us who are experiencing a joy that is lifting their spirits up, or a sorrow weighing their spirits down, to bring that joy or sorrow to the light of this faith community. After a brief musical interlude that Jim has volunteered to play for us, right? Do you remember that? We'll open the microphones and Mike McNeil will instruct us on how we can participate this morning in matters of the heart. Mm-hmm. let's bring this time of sharing to a close by singing Spirit of Life. Jim will play and lead us in singing it.
Am I unmuted? Is I okay? I am. Spirit of life, come unto me, sing in my heart all the stirrings of compassion, blow in the wind, rise in the sea.
Now we extinguish our chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of compassion, the fire of commitment, and certainly not the hope that in our lives, in our communities, in our nations, we will find ways to resolve conflict without violence and promote the conditions that will alleviate poverty, injustice, and all the other evils that precipitated.
And may your life be as a song, resounding with the dawn, to sing awake the light, then softly serenade the stars, ever dancing circles in the night. My wish for you, as now we part, is for greater peace to fill your heart with dreams as vast as starry space. So hurt and anger know no place. May truth be shared and wounds be healed, and joy for living be revealed. Through every vein and circumstance, may hope lead weary steps to dance. And may your life be as a song, resounding with the dawn, to sing awake the light, then softly serenade the stars, ever dancing circles in the night. This turns out to be a round. Entertaining yourself by singing it, the second phrase. Or if you're lost, you can just sing the same line over and over again. May your life be as a song, resounding with the dawn, resounding. May your life be, sing awake the light, then softly serenade. Ever dancing circles in the night. Ever dancing circles in the night. Ever dancing circles in the night. Let us forgive ourselves for coming here, exchanging lofty words, and returning home unchanged. Forgive the fireworks' theatrical flare, sounds bitten, short and exciting, as we carry them home toothless. Forgive our poetic sophistication when our actions fall so short of our ideals. Let's make a pact to release just one attachment, alter one degree of posture, find one element of style our lives can do without. One small step we'll take on our journey toward harmony. Resist one seductive appeal. Walk away from one bad deal of immediate gratification exchanged for loss. For there is, in fact, little time for the change. Our awareness is growing. We've made changes in our lives before. We're too proud to panic. We will not surrender civility for an enlightenment of oversimplification. We are volunteering. We are preparing our receptivity for the revolution in consciousness. And when we meet again, our words will be stronger.
Again, thank you, Jim, for a thoughtful, inspiring service. Preston is waiting in the wings here to deliver announcements, after which Jim will also entertain us with a postlude.
Go your way in peace. Make our